Welcome to Wise at Work, the podcast exploring the intersection of science, culture, and meaning in the workplace. I'm Corey Smith, CEO of Wisdom Labs, and your host. In this episode, Wisdom Labs Chief Science Officer Parneet Pal talks with Michelle Bousquet. Michelle is the Senior Director of Organizational Development at GoPro. In addition to her passion for building efficient, cohesive, productive, and happy company cultures, and creating high-performing and inspired teams, Michelle has a unique personal story that I think you'll find especially powerful. And now, Michelle Bousquet, interviewed by Parneet Pal.
So welcome to the Wise at Work podcast, Michelle. Really happy to have you here today. And the reason that I'm so excited about our conversation is because we're going to be talking about a particular quality of leadership that is not well known, that's probably really surprising to most of our listeners, but is also really, really important when it comes to both success at work and performance at work. But what we're also finding out is very crucial to our health and well-being. And in fact, it's so crucial that even Jack Ma, who is entrepreneur, founder of Alibaba, billionaire, even he sort of points to it. He calls it the love quotient. And he says that this is a quality that every leader needs to pay attention to. And he says it's even more important than IQ or EQ, which is the emotional quotient. So obviously, we are talking about sort of a taboo word, love. And we're not referring to romantic love or love that we have for our family and friends. We're talking about love at work, those little small moments of care and warmth and connection that we have with our team members. And when it comes to leaders who sort of embody this quality of love and compassion in the workplace, I couldn't think of a better one than you, Michelle. I've had the absolute pleasure of working with you at GoPro. I've seen how you show up with your teams. And I've also known you to say that bringing love to work, to have love be a value that team members practice, is sort of central to the way that you lead. So can you tell us a little bit more about what does that mean in practical terms when you say have love be a value that team members practice?
So for me, love in the workplace is not about being kind or being nice. What I mean by that is allowing there to be a true experience of understanding and shared purpose and kind of appreciation for a moment in time that was shared with a group of people and acknowledging that as a form of love. So for me, it's about, in a way, being in reverence of the fact that here we all were sharing this work and this purpose and even this day or this meeting. And wasn't that remarkable? And if we could create a sense of appreciation for that and of bringing our best and of seeing one another, and we could understand that as a form of love, it would be interesting. You know, and I live that way of, I used to call it other things, but now I call that love. Uh-huh. And I could tell you a little bit about when that concept formed for me. I spent years of my career being in sort of work that I loved and around people that I really appreciated, but I didn't have a true experience of love in that role. And there were many mornings where I woke up thinking, this isn't my true purpose. And I was at a networking dinner, and there was a CEO and a CFO of a rather large company, and they were both there together. And they told a story of how when they traveled together on business trips and they parted ways at the airport, they would shout across the airport, I love you, I love you. And they would kind of call it back and forth in their business suits. And everyone would look at them thinking either they must be brothers or maybe they're married or, you know. And I just had such appreciation for that sentiment. And it seemed so far away, yet what an incredible aspiration to actually love the people that you work with. And these were two people that had never known each other before at all. And so that became a bit of a stake in the ground for me to strive for. What would the experience of being available to sort of opening your heart even further to be available to that kind of relationship with people that you shared work with?
If only all of us could have bosses and managers and supervisors who share this idea. And we obviously know from the research and from surveys that, unfortunately, that's not the case. So, for example, there was a Gallup survey that was done a while ago, and 65% of the respondents in that survey, all employees in different organizations, they said that having a better boss or manager would make them happier. Right. Oh, and only 35% said that a pay raise would do the same. So clearly, you know, having leaders who sort of embody this sense of appreciation and love for their team members and doing it in an open way is crucial to the happiness of the teams. And it turns out even for their health. So there's been a lot of research done at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, for example. And they found that if you worked for a boss that you didn't like, who was inconsiderate or aloof, maybe even hostile in some ways, you actually had a 25% higher risk of having a heart attack. And if you hung out with this boss for 4 years or more, your risk increased up to 60%. But then the good news is that folks who hang out with leaders like you and the CFO and the CEO that you were describing in that example, your risk of having a heart attack actually goes down by 40% when you compare that with the regular population. So I just find these statistics really startling, but also sort of very empowering. As you talk about what bringing love to the workplace looks like, I also know that you sort of have a few core beliefs that sort of guide your way as a leader. Could you share a little bit more about those beliefs?
Sure. And that's an amazing piece of research, by the way, and one that we see all the time anecdotally. You know, we see people leaving not because they didn't like how much money they were making, but they left their boss, essentially.
Yeah.
We hear that a lot, whether it was because they didn't feel like they were growing, but mostly because they didn't have that connection.
Yeah.
So as for sort of core beliefs of mine, I do have a few core beliefs. And the first one I would say is that work should look a lot less like work than it does today. So I'm kind of fascinated by this idea, but work is a place where we act differently than we do in other areas of our life. So for example, when we need to discuss something at work, we gather around in a conference room normally, or in someone's office, but normally in a conference room. We all sit in a chair in a particular way. We all put certain things on the table, our phones, our laptops, our notepads. We usually project something on a screen, and we all stare at it. And some of us check out and, you know, read our phones and while other people are listening because we're bored or disengaged or whatever. My view is we don't do that anywhere else. If I need to have a discussion with my family, I might do it around the kitchen table, but I'm never going to project anything. I'm never going to be looking at my phone while my husband's talking, and I'm bringing a more wholly present part of myself to that home experience. So I'm curious about why we conduct work in a way that doesn't reference any of the other sources of joy mm-hmm. that we have in our life. So one of the things that I like to do, for example, is just do things a little bit differently. So if there's an opportunity to have a one-on-one walking around the parking lot, let's do that. There's no reason I need to be sitting and looking you in the eye. Absolutely no reason. I know the conversation will be better if I'm breathing fresh air, for example. I think about how we conduct work. So the very first thing I do, for example, is ask people to put away their technology just because, again, that's not something I would ever do outside of work. So there are just these little ways where we act differently. And I believe we access a different part of our brain when we go into a, quote, work setting. So I'm trying to learn from my personal life and others' personal lives and the things that bring them joy, and then sort of do work and have conversations and listen to one another just like I would if I was home.
That's beautiful. And it sort of also highlights just how naturally we can start becoming more mindful and more present for these important conversations at work and sort of setting that technology and that distraction aside.
So another core belief that I have, in addition to the work shouldn't look so much like work idea, is that we should really be open to bringing our entire self to work. This is not a new concept, and it's certainly not only mine, but somewhere along the line, we learned that we should have a professional version of ourselves if we wanted to succeed. I know I learned that. So I spent my first years in my career really building a persona that had no personal feelings about anything outside of work, that was very professional. And when asked about my weekend, I would give the right level of detail. I would read in someone's eyes whether or not they were checking out at my oversharing about my husband or, you know, whatever detail, and very much try to be like a non-human, like a worker, mm-hmm. I guess to make myself sort of invisible. And if I ever felt emotional about something that was happening outside of work, what I did was went to the restroom, like most people do, and shed a tear in the stall.
Yeah.
And then I came back to my desk. And so my idea and the sort of idea that I try to live by is whatever may be going on for me outside of work, whatever I may be managing, whatever my beliefs are and my thoughts are and the whole envelope of who I am is the person that needs to show up to work every day. And I certainly doesn't mean I spend all my time talking about myself and making others uncomfortable or bored, but it means that I don't have anything to hide. I'm showing up with everything that's influenced me and shaped me from the past and kind of willing to share that. And then by doing that, allowing other people to connect with that and share and sort of understand me as just a human being, not a infallible leader, not a perfect person, just kind of another human who has a different role than the person that I'm interacting with at that time.
So Michelle, what you've just described is paralleled in what we're finding out in the research around trust and trust at work. So Amy Cuddy is a social psychologist. She's a Harvard Business School professor. And she has been studying why some leaders have this ability to create teams that are really trusting of one another. And what she's found is that what tends to happen, exactly what you were describing, is that when we go to work, we're sort of programmed and conditioned to show up with leading with our strength. You know, leading with this is I'm really good at XYZ skill and you should listen to me because of this. Sort of having that very sort of professional and strength oriented way of being. But what she finds is that the other part of ourselves, which is sort of our warmth and our authenticity and our ability to just sort of connect with others in a very genuine way and actually be concerned about their well-being, this aspect, this warmth, is actually what separates excellent leaders from the basic kind of leader. And so what Amy Cuddy then encourages us to do as leaders is to lead with that warmth rather than leading with our competence. And just to your point of if you're able to show up as a leader and say, well, you know, I screwed up or, you know, I made a mistake or something not so great is happening in my personal life and I'm feeling a little vulnerable right now. These are the moments of connection. These are the moments that build that trust that is such a precious, precious quality of effective teams. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I'm so inspired in my own studies by, for example, Carol Dweck's work on mindset.
Yes.
And I see this growth and fixed mindset show up in the exact way that you described with coming to work with the goal of proving that I deserved the job I got mm-hmm. and letting everyone know how smart I am and that, you know, I should be the boss because I'm clearly superior. And so many of us are trying to do that and trying to hide this imposter mentality and this fear that we're going to be found out for not knowing. And I love the idea of just shifting it on its head and leading with every day I'm doing at least one thing that I've never done before. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have no idea at all what I'm doing. And my goal every day is to get a little bit better than I was the day before. And as soon as I've just kind of led with that, it's really just unlocked such a layer of stress in me personally. And I encourage my team to do that. So I really connect with the work that you mentioned and just feel so much better to come to work to learn versus then to prove how smart I already am.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Coming to work to learn, not to prove yourself. Mm-hmm. Love that. So I want to, Michelle, just switch gears a little bit. And I know that some of the folks who are listening right now are probably squirming in their chairs. And I'm sure they're thinking, well, love, you know, all this talk about compassion. And it just sounds really squishy. It sounds really soft to me. And doesn't it just mean, Michelle, that you're the super kind and nice person who gets walked all over when you show up at work? And of course, you know, you and I and the research show otherwise, but I would love to sort of hear your viewpoint on that. You know, leading with heart and being authentic and compassionate is actually not for the faint-hearted.
That's right. I laughed when you said that because all my life I wanted to be the person that people would vote nicest person I know.
They probably do.
I want to say that they don't. I don't show up in that lens. I don't think anyone would say I'm the opposite of that, but I don't present as a really nice person. And I'm glad you asked that because I feel passionately about love being separated from this, whatever the concept would be, being nice or being ingenuine. What I mean by being kind of full-hearted is actually being quite bold and caring deeply enough about either another person or a situation to really invest my whole heart into it and to be courageous enough to tell the truth as I see it because I respect the person and the thing that's going on. So the end goal is not sort of a campaign. I had a mentor who used to call it running for mayor, when you would sort of go around trying to like campaign your personal brilliance or be very nice and get people to like you. The commitment is more to it being better or to it having meant something. And it being either the relationship with the person, the workplace, the culture, the work that we were doing. It's sort of like giving a damn and being really committed to my best and to seeing the best in others and helping elevate the best in them, even when that means a tough conversation or letting someone go, you know, for example. So it's really about showing up with an investment and then being available to, I think, things being as best as they possibly could be. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. In fact, I absolutely love what you said, you know, the fact that being loving and compassionate means being able to lean into those moments of stress and overwhelm and somebody else's suffering and being able to stand there rather than being overwhelmed by it or avoiding it. I think what you're really underscoring is the fact that, you know, the core of compassion is not kindness. This is one of the biggest misconceptions out there. The core of compassion is courage. Now, one other thing that we know, Michelle, from the research is that all of us innately lie on a spectrum going from low to high compassion. This is based on our genes, it's based on the life experiences that we have. But the good news that we know from the research is that no matter where you lie on that spectrum, you can build this quality and this capacity. So I want to know, Michelle, like in your own life, have you always been sort of this fierce and this brave? How would you describe your place on that spectrum?
I have definitely evolved in this area. I did not start as kind of a Grinch, but I was quite guarded, I would say. I used to sort of loathe like any nice act being performed in my direction. Like if I dated someone and they sent me flowers, I would break up with them promptly.
Oh, nice.
And, there was just this, I don't know if it's fear of intimacy or just ick factor that kind of made my skin crawl when people were overly, quote, nice. So I definitely didn't start out being a very open-hearted person. I've always cared deeply about people and felt the world, but I did have an aversion to anything that looked like niceness or warmth. That said, I think I've always craved a sort of connection with people and didn't really know how to do it, right? I've worked with so many people now where what they crave is belonging, and so what they do is push others away. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. I think I was in that camp. But there definitely have been some pivotal moments and experiences in my life that have helped me become the leader that I am today and sort of build the point of view that I have today. I would say the most pivotal experience in my life started sort of an evolutionary process about actually almost 5 years ago. Exactly. It will be 5 years ago on Monday. I had my third child. Her name was Cora. And I had two little kids at home. When Cora was born, we had three kids under 4 years. And, you know, I've always been kind of a very low-key, non-dramatic person. And so I carried through that third pregnancy, you know, worked all the way up until the day she was born and worked full-time. I've always had kind of heavy-hitting jobs, I'll say. And so I sort of thought I was old hat at this child-having business. And what happened when I had Cora was that from the moment she was born, she had just a slew of medical challenges. So we had no indication that anything was wrong when she was, when I was pregnant. But she, you know, from the very beginning, she coded in the delivery room and sort of started this long journey with us. She was resuscitated and was okay then. But when she was 2 days old, we found out she had some substantial heart problems and we transferred to a big medical facility and she had her first open heart surgery at 8 days old. And I'll go into more of Cora's story, but I think all my life, part of that touchy-feely aversion was sort of a commitment to like things looking a certain way and being like, what does good look like? And I naturally had this fear always of like, what would it look like to have kids with challenges? And we kind of see other people out in the world with kids that, you know, maybe looked different or clearly had a lot of stuff going on. And I would think that their parents were sort of like part of a do-gooder boot camp, you know, or had, had opted into this particular life circumstance because they looked so much more qualified than I ever would be. And I really attached myself to like my kids hitting these certain benchmarks and kind of really looking cute. And, you know, I wouldn't admit that if you would have asked me 5 years ago, but it's very clear to me in the way that I lived my life that it was important to me sort of look good. Mm-hmm. And so Cora was born with these challenges, and she, after that first open heart surgery, she really struggled and took 5 weeks to get her home after that, during which time, you know, she still needed some support. She was had different medical devices and things when we came home, and I just felt completely ill-equipped to handle this situation. So, like, completely. And there's that fear you have when you have a new baby that's completely healthy, and you come home from the hospital, and it's like, oh my God, you know, what do they want me to do with this person? And it was just magnified when we brought Cora home from the hospital because she needed all this support and all this help. And so anyway, it was sort of like I was afraid of my own reality, and I was very guarded about my situation. So people would constantly flood us, you know, friends and family with how's Cora and what's going on. And I only wanted to tell them the bare minimum because I was so petrified of my own situation that it's like I could hardly talk about it. So unfortunately, after we brought Cora home from the hospital and tried to adjust to this new reality, she continued to get ill. And we went in and out of the hospital several times before finally going in again and not leaving a hospital for 5 months. So at that time, Cora was diagnosed with a life-threatening heart illness, another heart illness that was completely unrelated from the first. And my whole life just continued to be tossed on its head, sort of at every turn. And the thing, though, was Cora had this way of patiently waiting for others to arrive at a place of peace. And it's hard to, you know, you might be thinking if you're listening to this, like, are we talking about a small infant? And we are. It's hard to describe the amount of power that this one being had and the amount of profound impact she had on me, but I will try. So what happened was we ended up going to a different hospital where Cora was going to have a heart transplant, which was a frightening, just overwhelming reality to think of your small child who you're kind of just getting to know waiting for a heart donation. It's a really kind of flattening place to be. And I remember one night in the middle of the night, I would kind of sleep in these like fits, you know, near her. And I went to her bedside in this intensive care unit. And I just had an overwhelming desire to be less closed off about her story and kind of like an inner resolve that if she wasn't going to be able to be out there in the world making her own way right now, maybe I could shine her light for her. And maybe I could amplify her message to others in a way that would be meaningful to anyone who wanted to be affected by that. So I went from being this really closed off person to deciding to write this really public blog about Cora and share her experience kind of on a daily basis and the way that I was feeling about her experience on a daily basis to anyone that wanted to read it. And this amazing thing happened through that dramatic shift in who I was and who I was willing to be in the world that I attribute to Cora, sort of motivating me to be more open-hearted. And that was kind of my first challenge or encouragement to be a little bit different than I was before. But to the extent that I would offer my heart or my perspectives kind of openly, I would be fueled 10 times, 100 times back. And people would attach to her message and and be changed by that. And then the momentum of others opening their hearts and connecting, we're able to kind of lift and buoy me and my family through everything that came. And Cora did not get her heart transplant. And she really went through so much in her life. And she ended up dying when she was 8.5 months old, after many, many ins and outs of the hospital and just a tremendous ride. And I had this experience where I was talking to a confidant and mentor afterward. And of course, I was absolutely devastated at her journey, which I always thought would end with a happy story and sort of like my personal road through hell and now back to my heavenly reality. And it didn't go that way, actually. So I had this experience where I was talking to a close friend and mentor, and I said, I just miss Cora so much. She had this way of being so fully present in every moment and just emitting a feeling of goodness and open-heartedness. And, you know, I would have the experience of doctors telling me that when they had breaks, they would sit in her room because it just felt good in there. And she could just kind of connect with anyone. And you just felt when you looked in her eyes, like everything you had ever done and everything you would ever be was fine. You know, it was enough. And I so admired this quality in her. And I was reflecting to the friend, like, how will I ever live in a world where Cora does not exist? And she said this thing to me, which I'm so grateful for, which is, why don't you dedicate all of your work for the rest of your life to being more like Cora? And it just was kind of an eye-opening experience, because for those months following her death, it was about grieving a world where she no longer was as an absolute. And this piece of feedback from a mentor was about embodying that model instead of missing it. So I would say that's the first thing that really transformed me into saying, maybe it wasn't kind of over when she died, my period of open-heartedness. Maybe my period of open-heartedness is an ongoing dedication to continuing to amplify that message of presence and love and acceptance that Cora showed me so beautifully in her life.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that story, Michelle. You know, I've had the privilege of hearing the story, a few more details. I've had the privilege of reading some of what you've written, and I would really encourage our audience to check out your blog, which is coralionheart.blogspot.com. One of the very powerful moments that you've described, by the way, you just write beautifully.
Thank you.
One of the powerful moments that really touched me on your blog was a moment where you described feeling the hum again with Cora. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that story?
Sure. So when I was pregnant with Cora, imagine me again a few years back being very grounded and practical and business as usual. I was sitting on the couch one night and I remember feeling this sensation that I could only describe as the feeling of someone humming in my abdomen. I was probably 36 weeks pregnant at that point. And it startled me right away. And I said to my husband, I think this baby is humming. I don't think that's possible. But still, I found it kind of delighting. And in the days following Cora's birth, they were so dramatic and kind of shocking that I forgot all about that hum until one day, about a week after her surgery, she was still not in consciousness and was in an intensive care room, really in the most dire of medical situations. If you've ever had a parent or child with cardiac surgery, it's about as scary as it gets. So here she was, you can kind of barely find her amidst all the cords. And I had her little hand that was laying kind of out. And I grabbed onto her hand, which she always held hands. She was one of the most beautiful hand holders that I've ever met from day one. And she held onto my finger. And as I was just sitting there, all of a sudden, this hum kind of transferred through her arm and right into my core. And I think I jumped back a couple feet out of shock, But it was an instant wash of, I don't understand that. I don't know what that is. But the feeling that accompanied her presence in that moment and the moment before was one of profound well-being, like a jolt of well-being in the form of electricity. And she was like a powerful rod through her life. There were other times where this hum came out, but it's one of the things I loved about her, and I ended up calling her my magic baby, because there are many things that skeptics will sort of have a hard time believing, and I would have too, believe me. But my own experience has been such that I've just seen it and lived it. So it's true for me.
It's so, so very touching. I mean, even just listening to you talk about Cora, I can just sort of feel her presence. So thank you so much for that. You know, you share a lot of your lessons and how that's sort of informed the way you show up as a leader. But I just want to read out for our audience just a few lines around one of the lessons that you'd learned from your blog, if I may. You write, in order to live through tragedy or even through the irritating or ridiculous parts of life, you have to practice radical acceptance. You have to look your life square in the face and say, can I live with this? Can I accept this exactly as it is, with absolutely no footnotes and no conditions? Cora, during her life and during her death, showed us how to do that brilliantly. I have accepted that Cora's life was the life, the perfect life she was meant to lead. Thank you, Michelle. Those are very powerful and really important lessons for the rest of us around the absolute power and brilliance of surrender, of acceptance of the present moment, and really shine a light on your brave, compassionate, courageous heart and your ability to not only be with that kind of challenge. What I absolutely love about you, Michelle, is that, as you mentioned, your blog started this movement. You volunteer at UCSF Children's Hospital, and you're on one of their advisory boards. So can you just share a little bit about how, even in the midst of so much going on at work, with Cora, your other kids, you still find the time to give back?
Yes. So I am very involved at UCSF. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I'm on a little bit of a hiatus with them. And I'll tell you why. After Cora's experience and my evolution with her, we actually have dealt with quite a difficult additional situation. So last summer, a year ago last summer, my daughter Cosette, who is five at the time, developed some serious neck pain and ended up having a tumor that had decimated one of the vertebrae in her spine. And so kind of overnight, we were in a neurosurgeon oncology regime. She wore a hard collar neck brace for almost 9 months, 24 hours a day. She had weekly chemotherapy for 13 months. And we were kind of flung into this other really dire medical situation. And I'm happy to tell you that Cosette is doing really well now. And throughout, I did stay involved in the Family Advisory Council, and I have had numerous opportunities to speak in front of panels of doctors and medical practitioners and other parents and nurses in an effort to share our story and kind of what had mattered to us and and what made the difference and what did healing look like, even when the outcomes weren't good medically. Right now, why I say I'm on a little bit of a hiatus is just having gone through the 13 months in the oncology world, I needed a little breather, to be honest. However, I will say I'm quite connected with the council still. I'm taking a breather from the monthly meetings. But I think the point you're trying to get at is sort of having the energy to get involved. And I'll say that's actually one of the greatest paradoxes that I've learned, is that the thing that I need in order to get me through is giving it away, whatever it is. So if I have a light to shine, or a sympathetic ear, or a story to share that could possibly help others, or a story to listen to, or a connection, if it cannot be about me and sort of my sad story of the day, I have the energy to live my sad story of the day. So I found this over and over again, is that even when I was in, you know, we were living inpatient in hospitals, it was always about finding out who needed someone to talk to. My husband and I always entered the hospital with this one thought: how can I be helpful today? And that thought enabled so many connections and just so many moments for sort of relating to others in a context that transcended a hospital life, such that people that spoke at Cora's funeral were her nurses. There were three rows of folks who attended her service that were working at the hospitals that she attended. And because we were showing up to see where we could be of help, it led to these incredible connections. And so those have always fueled my ability to get through. And even as ironic as that might sound.
It's ironic, and just sort of getting back into sort of how it's working in your brain and body, it's not surprising, because what we know is that when we give back, the research, when they look at folks who volunteer versus those who don't, all other factors being equal, when you follow people as they do in research studies for many years, what they find is that folks who volunteer live longer and live healthier than folks who don't. And this is after you control for every other factor. And again, keep in mind, both of these groups, those who volunteer and who don't, are going through an equal number of stressors in their life. So both groups go through divorce or an illness or job loss. And so it's really fascinating, but it's really underscoring your experience as well here, is that even in the midst of all of that adversity, the fact that you found the strength to lean into that suffering, but also to use that as an opportunity to give back, is sort of fuel to your own resilience. And so thank you. I think that's such a stellar example of what we study in research papers, but you're sort of a shining real life example of what's possible when we go back. And I really hope that our audience members sort of take this to heart, because a lot of the times we think, you know, life is just too busy. I have too many things on my to-do list. I can't even finish this. You know, the last thing I can think of is giving back. And in fact, what you're encouraging us to do is, it's exactly in those moments of when you're feeling overwhelmed, is to reach out and help somebody else. Michelle, for those of us who are listening to this conversation, I know that one of the burning questions in their mind is, wow, this was really powerful. And, you know, what are the one or two or three things, small things, big things that I can do to become this kind of loving and compassionate leader wherever I am? So what would your suggestions be?
Yeah, so a few come to mind. I think the first one is, I want to put a full disclaimer out there that I am just someone who is on my journey of leadership. Sometimes when you listen to podcasts or things, it's easy to think that the person has it all figured out and kind of, you'll never be like that. And I want to say that I'm just a little bit better leader than I was 5 years ago, or a lot better than I was 10 years ago. So I guess along those lines, the first thing would be, the most important quality you can have as a leader is presence. I have found this to be absolutely true, that if I know no other action, the best thing I can do, even in the most difficult moments, is be there fully. Be fully listening to understand instead of to respond. So I'm kind of holding the space to allow something to form. That's often the simplest basis for building trust. The second suggestion that I would give is leaning in a little bit to this idea of seeing others. So I lead a lot of workshops through the course of work, or strategic planning meetings, or, you know, kind of team development exercises. And usually people walk away and they feel like, oh, that meeting was, you know, so amazing. And I kind of chuckle, because it almost doesn't really matter what the business outcome was. The thing that people attached to was that there was a shared space for them to see one another as human beings and as working alongside at the same moment as someone else. So this goes back to the concept I talked about with work looking a little less like work. Mm-hmm. If we're not afraid to let there be meaning, to let something have had an emotional value, we have possibilities for those connections and those feelings of depth and trust. I'll give an example. If you break people into pairs to discuss a problem at work versus having a large boardroom talk about a problem where only the extroverts are heard, people will inevitably see one another because there's no one else to listen to than the one person in front of them. So even if they're talking about business, they will see one another and their style, and they will be working together on something in a way that is unlike the way we normally do work in large groups. So there are these little tactics where you just basically create a space for people to see one another a little bit differently. And the team itself has a collective kind of raise in its own feeling of goodness or well-being, because after all, we were just humans, not workers. We were just sort of humans in this space, in this time, and didn't we appreciate that? So the last suggestion that I will say in terms of kind of what can you do is, don't be afraid to share a bit of yourself. There were so many times during Cora's life where the way that I showed up to work was with tears in my eyes. And by the way, many times afterward, because of course when we lose someone, we don't close a book on the emotions that come with that. But there were so many times where the very best that I could do was show up. And to try to hide kind of what was going on for me would have been ridiculous. And so it was the best that I could do to just start the meeting with tears in my eyes and then kind of move on to the business. My view of myself was that I was kind of a mess. My team's view of me was admiration and also kind of a willingness and setting the ground rules that it was all right to just show up as who we were. So I take a lead from that success that the more that I can openly show, even if it's just I'm really tired today or I'm so stressed because I dropped the ball and my boss just gave me a really nasty email. So that's what I'm bringing into this conversation with you. If I can just share what's behind the curtain a little bit more, it lays the groundwork for my team to do the same, but also to trust, like, I have your back. You know, I'm here as a whole human, and I'm interested in you, and I'm bringing sort of everything I've got, and I guess let's just be together in that.
Jeff Weiner, who is the CEO of LinkedIn and sort of a champion for compassionate leadership, recently tweeted, he said, "The big misconception about managing compassionately is that it's a soft skill. Most compassionate people I know are typically the strongest." Thank you so much, Michelle, for embodying this quality of love and compassionate leadership so brilliantly. We are really thrilled that you were able to participate in this podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, it's Corey, co-founder and CEO of Wisdom Labs. At Wisdom Labs, we're helping companies become wiser workplaces. To create this positive impact in organizations, we cultivate change at the level of the individual, team, and company culture. We see businesses as the biggest lever for positive social change at scale. After all, business still holds the most power and influence in our world. And as individuals, company cultures, and entire stakeholder networks become more wise, we all benefit. To learn more about Wisdom Labs, check out wisdomlabs.com. Thanks for listening.